I'm going to say good morning to all of you. We are coming close to the end of our study of the Beatitudes. So if you'll turn to Matthew chapter 5, I think the way I'd like to start this morning is simply to read through the Beatitudes and try to get fixed in our minds a little bit better the context in which we're studying. We are looking at the last of these, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in just a moment. Starting at verse 3 of Matthew 5, "How blessed are the poor in spirit, the kingdom of heaven is theirs. How blessed are the gentle or the meek, they will have the earth as an inheritance. How blessed are those who mourn, they will be comforted. How blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, they will have their fill. How blessed are the merciful, they will have mercy shown to them. How blessed are the pure in heart, they will see God. How blessed are the peacemakers, they will be recognized as children of God. How blessed are those who are persecuted in the cause of uprightness, the kingdom of heaven is theirs." And then it goes on to take that last beatitude, all of the beatitudes so far, blessed are those, blessed are those, blessed are those. He now in verse 11 says, blessed are you. When people abuse you and persecute you and speak all kinds of falsehoods against you on my account, rejoice and be glad. One translation says, be exceedingly glad, for your reward will be great in heaven. This is how they persecuted the prophets who came before you. I told you last week that I saw an analogy or a parallel here. And I gave you a little bit of that analogy or parallel last week and told you that I would tell you a little bit more about it this week. So this is more in the spirit of helping you see a parallel that I think may help you understand this beatitude. But it is rather personal. I hope you'll enjoy the tale. The sentence I gave you last week was, for 12 days, I was part of the 82nd Airborne. For 12 days, I was part of the 82nd Airborne. When I was in graduate school, I had a draft number, which was a very fortunate and favorable draft number. That meant that had the draft numbers been called early enough, mine would have been one of the first five or six to be called. That's what a favorable draft number was. It turned out that that didn't happen because the draft board that I was associated with had decided it was time for me to go much earlier than that. And in the process of going, I found a way to go in through the Reserve Officer Training Corps at the college where I was in graduate school. The sergeants at basic training called it ROCT, which I thought was a hilarious way of expressing that. But in essence, I went through basic training at Fort Benning, came out of that signing on the dotted line to be part of ROTC, but signing in such a way that if I ever decided not to be part of ROTC, I would immediately be drafted as a private into the Army. So I was a soldier. I was in the Army. The analogy I gave you last week, and I think I probably need to be a little bit more careful how I draw it. Some people that had served in the military had some conversations with me after the last hour, suggested a rewording here or there, and so I'll try to be a little bit more correct in this. It is the nature, it is in the expectations of a soldier that they will face combat. The thing they took issue was, they said, I don't feel it was in me to kill, but I was trained to do that. That was part of my training, was to go into combat. So it is in the nature of a soldier, properly trained, to be ready for combat. Not every soldier will go into combat, but it is part of the training of a soldier to be ready for it if it comes. There was a report from the Department of Defense this week. Did you see it? I believe I'm getting it correct. I didn't clip the article, so I may not have it quite right. The Department of Defense issued a report. This was a true report as opposed to other reports you may have heard this morning. Dr. Collins said the same thing in your hour that he said in mine. This report gave the number of combat soldiers as a percentage of the total military. And it was about 10%. So there's cooks and there's drivers and there's accountants and there's administrative people, there's medical people, there's supply people and all this kind of stuff. When you look at the fraction of the military, whatever branch, that is actually aimed at combat, it's about 10%. But if you've ever seen the movie Patton, you know Patton expected his cooks to be ready to fight. And that's certainly true in the Marines. If you're in the military, they train you to be ready to fight. It is in the nature of a soldier to expect to face combat, and it's in the training of a soldier to be ready for that. The parallel that I want to give you with this last point, it is in the expectation of a Christian. It should be in the training of a Christian to be ready to face persecution, to be ready to face what Jesus calls people abusing you and persecuting you and speaking all kinds of falsehood against you for my sake. It is in the nature of a Christian to face that. And it's in the nature of a Christian to expect that a Christian would be trained to be ready to endure that or to experience that. So that's the setting of that. Now, I promised you that I would fill in just a little bit more about I was in the 82nd Airborne for 12 days. When I finished all of my training and was commissioned as a second lieutenant, for reasons that are not important, but it is a part of the story, they decided, they ranked all of the soldiers, all of the people who had been commissioned as second lieutenants in the Army that year, in Third Army, which is the southeastern United States. They rank ordered them, and then what happened was, if you were wherever you were in the rank, you would get your selection of what branch to go into immediately behind whoever was right in front of you and immediately ahead of whoever was right behind you. And for reasons that are not important, I ended up as number one on that list for Third Army. And there's weird reasons for that that are not important. But I had my choice. Any branch I chose, that was the branch I would have gotten. Very few people are that fortunate. I'm a chemist. I had just finished graduate school. I was in the process of finishing graduate school, and I knew I was going to have a doctorate degree in chemistry. I chose the chemical corps. Somewhere in my archives, I have photographs of me firing a flamethrower. Part of the expectations for a chemical corps officer were that you would not only know how to operate a flamethrower, but you know how to train people to do that. If you have read any of the stories of World War II, when the landings came on Okinawa and other places, they would generally single out people to kill who were carrying radios, who were carrying machine guns, or who were carrying flamethrowers. Those were sort of the big three. We also learned how to make smoke. We were in, for my basic officer training in the Army after my commission to Fort McClellan in Alabama, we made smoke. It turned out there was a temperature inversion across that part of central Alabama. The smoke did not go up and dissipate. It settled. It then flowed, and the city of Birmingham experienced the worst smog it had ever had in 25 years. And we knew why that was, but we weren't talking. They had a very curious smell. They produced their own, and so, you know, ours just sort of added to it, but it was, the worst was that particular day. We were also charged with helping troops prepare for and be ready to defend themselves against and still fight during nuclear attacks or biological attacks or chemical attacks. So we had to know how to detect such agents if they were used and how to help troops to know how to protect themselves against that and continue to do their mission within that context, and lots of other things. Okay, so I was trained as a chemical officer. I went through basic officer course and all this, and they said so many people had gotten into ROTC and National Guard and all that, they didn't have a place for me on active duty, they didn't have a place for me in the active reserve, and so they gave me the opportunity to extend my service by 2 years. Most people, 2 years active and 4 years of reserves. I was given the opportunity for no years of active except a little bit for the basic officer course and 8 years of inactive reserve. Now, inactive reserve means they can call you up anytime, but they probably won't. So that's what happened. I finished my stint at McClellan. I went to other places and eventually came to Richmond. And 5 years in, I get this phone call out of the blue, and they said, you know, it's about time for us to promote you to first lieutenant. And we don't promote people we haven't seen in 5 years. So consequently, what we would like to do is to have you go to Fort Bragg and spend 2 weeks and just let us see you. So I was attached to a chemical unit at Fort Bragg. And yeah, after letting the uniforms out a little bit. Actually, let me say something about that as well. My father and mother gave up their house and went into a retirement home a little over a year ago. I collected all the pictures that I could find in the house, many of which were slides. And within the last week, I had found some pictures of me taken during the last week or so at Fort Benning. That was basic training. I have ROTC on my lapel, and I'm standing there next to a car. And I was in fighting trim. I am far from fighting trim today, and if one wanted to plot a graph, the graph would be pretty linear from where I was to where I am. But there was a day when I was in fighting trim, and I had was 5 years away from that. So, yeah, the uniforms had to be. Thank you, Barbara. Anyway, I'm ordered to report at 7:30 in the morning on a Monday morning in May. And maybe it was June. I think it was May. And I reported at 7:30, drove down on Sunday, and reported at 7:30 to a lieutenant colonel who's in charge of this chemical unit. And the guy says, welcome. You're a college chemistry teacher, right? Yeah. Good. We've got an assignment for you. I said, what's that? He said, well, part of our nuclear, biological, and chemical training of the troops is that we're required to give them tests to find out if they learned the things we've trained them on. And we have all their tests from the last couple of years. We'd like you to grade those tests. They were all multiple choice. And so he took me in a room, gave me a desk and some things to write with. And he said, okay, start on these. And here's two stacks of papers about this talk. Okay? So I go through and I grade the things. This was maybe 8 o'clock in the morning. About 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd finished these two stacks. And I went into the colonel's office and I said, okay, I finished those. Where some more? Colonel's jaw dropped and he said, we thought that would take you 2 weeks. That's all there is. So he says, why don't you just go back to the BOQ, the Bachelor Officer Quarter. There's a PX next door. You can get a paperback book. They got a pool. Come back tomorrow. I said, okay. So when should I come back? 7:30? Oh, no, he said. Come back at 10. By then, we'll probably find something for you to do. So that was Tuesday. I came back about 10. Worked till about 1:30. Next day was Wednesday. I came in about 9:15, 9:20. Worked until about 1. And Friday, at about 2 o'clock, the colonel says, what's going on at home this weekend? I said, well, actually, one of my kids is having a birthday party. Oh, you got to go to that. I said, sir, I've read my orders. My orders are you are to be at Fort Bragg for 2 weeks. And he says, not if I say differently. And he pulls out his paper, writes me a new set of orders. I go home, show up for the birthday party, and surprise my family and all this kind of stuff. When should I be back? Oh, noon on Monday will be fine. So I drove back down on Monday morning, and knocked off about 2:15 or so. Got a little more sun out on the pool. Tuesday afternoon, Tuesday was the same. Tuesday afternoon, about 2 o'clock, I made the fatal assumption. I assumed Tuesday was just like Monday, was just like all the days of the previous week. I walked into his office. There's a major sitting there with his boots up on the desk. And I said, well, sir, I finished all these things. I guess I'll go home now. And the major says, and I remember the tone of voice. I remember the look in his face. You ain't going anywhere, boy. You're confined to the barracks. I looked at the colonel. I said, what's he talking about? Don't worry about that, son. We're all confined to the barracks. There's a civil war in Zaire. And American and French civilians are trapped in the middle of the civil war. President Carter has put the 82nd Airborne on alert to go. I remember thinking, I was smart enough not to say it, what does that have to do with me? I think the colonel anticipated that because he looked. And by the way, just in case you don't know this, you are part of the 82nd Airborne. When we go, you're going to go. There'll be MPs here in a minute or two. They'll take you down to the warehouses. You will draw field gear. You will draw weapons and ammunition. I've been on the phone with the general who's in charge of the 82nd Airborne. At the time this alert went out, I contacted him to let him know, we've got this crackerjack officer down here who doesn't have an assignment. He's not on the table of organizations. We can use you anywhere. And when there's not a chemical or biological threat, this office becomes a supplement to the logistical support for the 82nd Airborne. We're going to send in a group of paratroopers to secure an airfield, and you're going to be in the second wave to come into that, and you're going to help bring all the equipment in. We're going to train you on the use of radio codes, reading manifests, being able to talk to ships and the planes, both the Navy and the Air Force, to get the supplies. Most of those supplies are already on their way. They're pre-deployed in Turkey. They're pre-deployed in Europe. They're pre-deployed in some other places. There's ships on the way already. But when we go, you'll go and you'll be on the second group of planes. And I said, can I call my wife and let her know I'm not going to be home on Friday? Oh, no, son. All contact with anybody off post is closed. Remember, you're a soldier. I remember that phrase. Remember, you're a soldier. They took me to a barracks that they hadn't used, a sort of a building, and all the stuff for call signs. If you've ever seen pictures of these plexiglass screens where you can write on stuff with one of these marking pens and stuff. They had those in there. One by one or two by two or three by three people who had various responsibilities came in and trained me. I trained until about, I was with these rotating groups of people until about midnight. They let me sleep for about 4.5 hours, had me back there at 5 the next day. That was Wednesday. I was there until midnight on Wednesday, back at 5 on Thursday. And by Friday, I was starting to realize I can do this. And I had also realized the people I thought were just sort of sitting there with their feet up and not really doing anything, lazy and all that, were people who were ready and more ready than I was. It was like you throw a switch. I got a respect for the Army that week. On Friday at 11 o'clock, the colonel comes into the room and says, the French just went in. Carter has called off the alert long enough that the people sleeping by the planes can get a shower. That'll be about 2 hours. If you can out-process in 2 hours, you can go home. I out-processed in 45 minutes. And I went home. For 12 days, I was part of the 82nd Airborne. It is in the nature of a soldier to be trained for and ready for combat. Doesn't mean they want it. Doesn't mean they look forward to it. But if it comes, they're fulfilling their role as a soldier. It is in the nature of a Christian to experience persecution. You don't want it. You don't look forward to it, but if it comes, you realize you're fulfilling part of the expectations that a Christian will have. It won't be every Christian that experiences it, but every Christian should be ready. I didn't realize that I could be ready as quickly as I was. I didn't go, but I had the loaded 45, and I had the loaded M16. Actually, it wasn't loaded, but the ammunition was there. Had the French not gone, I'd be a combat veteran. That's how close I came. Totally and completely out of the blue, unexpected. And the training that I had back here made me more ready than I would have ever expected 5 years later. It is in the nature of a soldier to expect to experience combat. That's what you train for. No matter what else you may do, not every soldier will experience that. But every soldier needs to be ready. It is in the nature of a Christian to experience persecution. That was the analogy, the parallel I was trying to make last week. And that own experience of mine still stands with me as something interesting. Now, I want to ask you this question. Jesus tells us to rejoice and not just be glad. One translation says be exceedingly glad when such times come. How can we do that? What perspective would make that a reasonable response to abuse, persecution, people lying about you? What perspective would make that work? Your turn. Yeah.
That you're following Christ, that you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, because otherwise, people that aren't following Christ, right? People that aren't going to talk about them or persecute them or any of the if you're doing what does say of the Lord, then you're going to be.
I think it's really important to say, all kinds of people get attacked for all kinds of reasons. We're talking about people getting this kind of attack for this kind of reason. Okay? Yes, ma'am. I can't. The hand was in between. There it's your hand, Mary Ellen.
It means you're doing it right.
And, yeah, we talked about this just a little bit last night. People get persecuted. You get persecuted because you're doing something that's becoming effective and people are threatened by that. I'm doing something right in this regard. What else?
Treasure faithfulness.
I want to get real personal for a second. I never thought I would have any chance of going into combat. I thought when I first went into ROTC there was a good chance I might end up in Vietnam, and I'd rather end up in Vietnam as an officer than as a police commander. And I admit that thought went through my head. I admit when I went through training, I tried to do everything they showed me. I tried to learn how to do everything they showed me because I thought they're teaching me things that if I learn these things, it might save my life and it might let me save somebody else's life. Would you now say again what you said?
It shows faithfulness.
It shows faithfulness. Yeah. Those things come to people who have been trained and have responded to that. Please don't think that I'm standing myself up anywhere near a combat veteran. I'm not. I just realized what it felt like to come back from that warehouse holding an M16 and the ammunition and a 45 and the ammunition and realizing I might be called on to use it within the next 5 days and my family wouldn't know. It suddenly made me realize what being a soldier was. And I don't think if I'd had that experience, I would really feel like I had been a soldier. In a way, I'm glad I had that experience. Yeah.
Is it not an opportunity? God allows you to do it.
Okay, I'm glad you put that in. It's an opportunity to draw closer to God. I think that's very much on target. Anybody else?
What came to my mind was Romans 5:3-5.
That people of joy and trouble and sufferings, because that will produce endurance, and endurance produces character, and character produces hope. There's all kinds of benefits there. There's a cascade of things that come out of that. So it provides an opportunity for this. It also provides an opportunity for those things. Yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Well, in Romans, in John 15, he talks about the world hating him first, so they and hate us. So we are God's children, and we are persecuted because of that.
They persecuted the prophets before you in exactly the same way. We are sharing Jesus and with God's. Do you understand why this analogy between soldier and Christian sort of takes on a little meaning for me? Because it means when I'm with a bunch of people who wore the uniform, I don't have to hang my head. The Army had me. They could do what they want with me. But that's not quite the same. It's just about to get on the plane and go. And I got close enough to where at least I have a sense of what it would feel like to have actually gotten on the plane again. Because for 3 days there, I thought I was going to do it. And, it allows you to have membership in a community that extends over the centuries. Let me take a minute and take you to a couple of places. Let me take you, first of all, to 2 Corinthians chapter 1. You want to put a little bookmark in 2 Corinthians? We're going to go back and forth, but we'll keep coming back to that book for a while. 2 Corinthians chapter 1. Let me start at verse 5. For just as the sufferings of Christ overflow into our lives, so does the encouragement we receive through Christ. So if we have hardships to undergo, this will contribute to your encouragement and your salvation. Let me pause and make sure you hear this. Paul is writing for Paul and a group of people to the people in Corinth. He's saying, if we have hardships to undergo, that will contribute to your encouragement and your salvation. If we receive encouragement, this is to gain for you the encouragement which enables you to bear with perseverance the same suffering we do. So our hope for you is secure in the knowledge that you share the encouragement we receive, no less than the sufferings we bear. Experiencing suffering brings God close. But notice what else happens. It brings God's people close. Did you see it? It brings God close. It also brings us closer to other Christian. Our encouragement encourages you. Sharing of suffering lets us share encouragement. Now, keep reading, starting in verse 8. So the hardships we underwent in Asia, we want you to be quite certain, brothers, that we were under extraordinary pressure, beyond our powers of endurance, so that we gave up all hope even of surviving. In fact, we were carrying the sentence of death within our own selves, so that we should be forced to trust not in ourselves, but in God, who raises the dead. He did save us from such a death, and He will save us. We're relying on Him to do so. Through times like this, we learn to trust God. So you've already talked about being closer to God, this extra dimension of learning to trust in God. I don't know which of the singers, there's a Christian singer a few years ago whose song ended with, when you come to the point where He's all you have, you find He's all you need. Something like that is expressed in here. Still in 2 Corinthians, turn over to chapter 4. Let me get you to start at verse 8. We are subjected to every kind of hardship, but never distressed. We don't see any way out, but we never despair. We are pursued, but we're never cut off. We're knocked down, but we still have some life in us. And always we carry with us in our body the death of Jesus. Here's the focal. So that the life of Jesus too may be visible in our body. Indeed, while we're still alive, we're still being continually handed over to death for the sake of Jesus, so that the life of Jesus too may be visible in our mortal flesh. We become more like Jesus.
It's an opportunity to become more like Jesus.
What was the scripture verse that supported the sermon today? The book of Acts, right? I don't think he took you to Acts 22. So let me take you to Acts chapter 22. Sorry, Acts chapter 20. Let me start at verse 22. Acts chapter 20, verse 22. Context, Paul is on his way to Jerusalem, and he's expecting when he gets there that he's probably going to die. But the Spirit is leading him to Jerusalem. And he's going to talk about that. He has paused for a moment at the edge of what we would today call Turkey to meet with some church leaders out of the church of Ephesus and probably some others from inland, churches that he had helped found during his missionary journeys. He's speaking to them, so my verse 22 starts with a continued quotation mark. And now you see me on my way to Jerusalem in captivity to the Spirit. I have no idea what will happen to me there, except that the Holy Spirit in town after town has made it clear to me that imprisonment and persecution await me. But I don't place any value on my own life, provided that I complete the mission the Lord gave me to bear witness to the good news of God's grace. The work that is done by people who are enduring persecution is what makes their lives worthwhile. What makes life worthwhile. Other than that, he said, my life is worthless. This is what makes life worthwhile. Turn to Romans 8. That's the next book after Acts. Romans chapter 8.
Got to be a little careful in trying to help you understand what we're about to read.
But I think it's saying something very important. Romans chapter 8, I want to start in verse 16. This is in the middle of a context that some of you will recognize. The Spirit Himself joins with our spirit to bear witness that we're children of God. And if we're children, then we're heirs. Heirs of God and joint heirs with Christ. Provided that. What are those words, provided that, express? A qualification, right? We're heirs of God, joint heirs with Christ, provided that we share in his suffering so as to share in his glory. Does our salvation depend on persecution? I don't think so. But the quality of our salvation can depend on that. There's a verse I think it's in 1 Corinthians, or maybe in 2 Corinthians, that says there are some people who are going to be saved as if they've been saved from a fire. They might have the clothes on their back, but they're going to be singed, and that's all they're going to have. There's other people who are going to be saved, and they have all kinds of things with them. What's the difference? Some of them built in gold and silver and precious jewels, and some of them built in hay and wood and straw, and the day that dawns in fire tests the quality of work. It's not the question of salvation, it's the question of the quality of salvation. The question of the quality of salvation. I'm going to do something. I think I'm right in this. Toward the end of the sermon in our hour, Travis Collins made a contrast between one kind of church and another kind of church. Did he do that for you? A church that started out strong with lots of good things happening in God's Son, and then slowly turning in a way that people don't even realize because the numbers are still there. But it's just numbers. And he says, I don't want our church to be like that. Right? It's still a church. People in that church are still saved. It's not a church that's accomplishing things. That's what I'm talking about with the quality. It's not, the question of salvation is not this. The question of the quality of salvation. So Romans tells us if we are willing to share any suffering, if we've prepared for that and trained for that, we're ready for it when it comes, then the quality of our experience in sharing his glory will be better. Think about that analogy and maybe you'll see what I'm talking about. Jesus did not come to earth to make life easy. He came to earth to make people great. Now I want to ask you, maybe there's a place up here that we can do this. What kinds of suffering did people in the first century experience?
What kind of suffering did the people in the first century experience? Yes, there's the easy ones. They face death. They face torture. They face imprisonment. Okay. That's one. What else? They face ridicule. Ostracism. I think I spelled ostrich and then told you to spell it something. Yeah. There was a disruption to social life, to family life, a disruption to work that previously you might have been able to do, you weren't going to do those things anymore. Okay. That was first century. Any of those things happen today? In some parts of the world, the church is under active persecution of the first time. People are dying, they're tortured, they're in prison for their faith. But there's still some of the rest of this going on. And usually when it comes, well, let me try to be careful about this. Let me make the transition to the next part because I think that'll be easier. Did Jesus suffer persecution? Clearly at the crucifixion he did. Did he experience that prior to that? Yeah. Okay, here's the question. Did he invite it? Did he go out looking for it? Once or twice, there's points that make it look like things had just gotten to a point that he responds full bore. But most of the time, I think an argument could be made. He didn't go looking for it, but did he avoid it? Most of the time, no. There were a couple of places where you see he says, my time is not yet, and a confrontation that was building, he'll avoid that. But most of the time, he was walking a tightrope between not inviting on the one hand, but not avoiding on the other hand. Right? If you got people that are just out looking for somebody to say something bad about them, you'd probably find a few takers. If you're out looking for people to treat you bad, and you give them all kinds of reasons for doing that. But we're talking here about things that come that you've not invited, but the way you've lived have brought them. And you don't avoid them most of the time. You might try to find a way to find a path through that that would bring God glory, but would maybe bring the people who are on the other side of the persecution to their senses. But if you look at the tightrope Jesus walked, it's kind of interesting. So what would have given reason for people to persecute or say false things or other things about Jesus? I have a proposal for you, and I want to know whether you accept it. It would be based on where did he go, who did he spend time with, what did he say when he was with these folks, and how did he say it? Maybe a few others, but I think those are probably big ones in whatever list you might build. So where did he go?
Jesus, in his lifetime on earth. Where did he go? He went all kinds of places. He would go to Jerusalem when there were festivals. And every once in a while when he went to Jerusalem, he'd go by the routes that took you through Samaria. So, you know, he went... Some of the things that other people would have done, he might have done something a little different. But he went from place to place. They said at one point he didn't have a bed to call his own. Didn't have a house to stay in. He was more like a fox or some animal, not having a permanent place to stay.
But he lived his life.
Yeah. Who did he spend time with?
He lived his life according to... Because he was Jewish, he went to Jerusalem. It wasn't something he did to call notice to himself. It's because it was his life. It was something he held faithful to. When he traveled with his disciples and he went to see friends, he went to Lazarus and he found friends everywhere he went, and he didn't avoid...
Yeah, I like that. Let's stay on that last one just a second. He found friends wherever he went. How did he find them? Where did he go? He went to the places that were open to him to go. Who did he spend time with? People who were willing to spend time with him. Sometimes that were people who were already his friends. Sometimes it was people who might be willing to become his friends. And he got criticized for some of that. Why do you spend all this time with tax collectors and sinners? What was his answer? They realize they need a physician. It's the sick people who go to the physician. Well, people don't have any need to go see the physician. Who did he spend time with? Did he spend time with enemies? Yeah. There's that one famous one where a Pharisee invites him to dinner, and in the middle of the dinner, this probably a prostitute was doing some things, and the Pharisee was saying all kinds of things about Jesus in his head, and Jesus says, wait a minute, I'm a guest of yours, and you skipped all the things that a guest is supposed to receive, all the hospitality of welcoming, you skipped all those things. She's doing those things now. You basically insulted me at least three times when I came in by withholding from me the fellowship. This wasn't Jesus' friend, but Jesus is still spending time with him. So, who did Jesus spend time with? He spent time with people who were willing to spend time with him. Where did he go? He went where the roads took him so that he could be among the people. What did he say? He found a way to build a relationship, and then out of that relationship, to build a connection with the eternal. But he never did it in a confrontive kind of way. At least not very often. The temple with the think that's one example. When he pointed the fingers at the Pharisees, woe to you, seven times, he did it another time. But if you look back at those things, there were things going along that built to that. And Jesus reached a point where, okay, now I've got to take it to that level. But he never jumped to that level. He was always moving to that level after other levels had failed. And how did he say things? Almost always he said things in ways that were not condemning, but were designed to get people to start thinking about their relationship with the Lord. He was going where he should have gone, according to God's will and God's invitation. He was spending time with the people God wanted him to spend time with. He was saying things God wanted him to say, and he was saying them in ways that God wanted him to say. And out of that, naturally, arose abuse and falsehood and persecution, including at the end of crucifixion. We call Jesus the suffering servant. Did he suffer? Of course. Was he happy? did he have joy? 2 weeks ago, a woman who has been given the right to do this came into my office, looked at me and said, "I don't think you're happy. And I don't think you're unhappy. I just don't think you're happy. And I think you have a right to be." The context she was talking about was that I'm department chair, and someday they may ask me to be department chair for another term. And the question was, should I say yes if that ever happens? And she's suggesting I might want to think about that in that context. But it got me to thinking, was Jesus happy? Criticism for the first hour. Happiness depends on circumstances. That's probably not a very good word. Maybe you ought to use the word joy.
Well, I agree. The scripture actually uses that word way more often than it uses happiness.
But there are translations of the Beatitudes that talk about happy the one who does so and so. Happy is the one. How blissful is someone who experiences this or experiences that. So the word is still, in that context, not inappropriate. She then asked me that question. Was Jesus happy? Isn't that interesting to be asked that in your office? And I thought for a minute, I looked there and I gave you the answer I just gave you. I think Jesus was. And I think then her question was, well, why? I think the answer was, he was doing what God wanted him to do, where God wanted him to do it, in the way that God wanted him to do it. I think that brought him happiness and joy. She then looked at me and said, I've seen you when you're happy. And you're happy when you're talking about spiritual things. And you're happy when you're talking about teaching your classes. I don't see you very happy when you talk about the work you do as department chair. Now, my own sense is that's not the reason to say no to something, so I'm still pondering her words. But I think this is an interesting question. Where did Jesus find joy? I think he found joy in doing what God wanted him to do, in the places that God wanted him to do it, in the way that God wanted him to do it, with the people he wanted him to do it. I think that's where Jesus found joy. Was Jesus so, Jesus is special. Was he so special that the way he found joy that has no relationship to how we might find joy? Are we allowed to find joy the same way? I asked the first hour to do a little exercise that I've already done. If you were to write down characteristics of Jesus, what would you say? What would be words that would be characteristics of Jesus? In this context of representing or giving evidence to the fact that he was happy and had joy.
Care.
He cared about others. That's what I'm hearing you say. Is that right?
He cared when they were happy. He cared when they came to where he wanted them to be.
What else? He's very measured in what he did. He did things for a purpose.
Measured in what he did, purposeful. What else?
Fulfilled.
What else?
Satisfied.
Secure. What else?
Patient.
Figured out yet what I'm doing?
No.
You are building three lists.
Yeah.
I don't know if you realize it or not. You're building three lists. There are characters of Jesus. There are characters of Jesus in relationship to others, and maybe the word available should move over to that list. There are then attitudes toward what he was to do. I ended up with two lists. I didn't divide it up quite this way, but in, both in the first hour and this one, yours is dividing more into three. I put down a list like this. Jesus was relaxed, informal, approachable, affable, interruptible, flexible. And yet, firm, focused, principled, not easily distracted, confident. Do you feel the difference between those two lists? Can you feel the difference between those two? If it was only one of those lists, he would be very different from who he is. Take your choice. I do not know where I saw the picture, but I saw a picture that somebody had painted of Jesus laughing in a crowd of people in a place that looked like a tavern. Just a real good time going on. I think that picture is important. But I think that picture needs to set by the side of the Jesus who said to his disciples, "Don't you stop those little kids from coming to see me." And you see Jesus with a kid in his arms. And the same one who has a woman prostrate in front of him, and he's been scribbling in the sand on the ground, and everybody around had stones they were ready to kill her with, and he says to her, "Woman, where are your accusers?" And for the first time she looks up and with wonder in her voice says, "They're gone. They're not here." Jesus says, "Well, I don't accuse you either. But go and sin no more." If he was only the happy guy in the tavern, he's not my Lord. If he's only the stern finger pointing person, he's not my Lord. Somewhere, Jesus found the ability to be relaxed, affable, approachable, flexible, at the same time, without any conflict.
He was firm, he was focused, he was disciplined, he was principled, and could not be pulled off of that. And you've caught pieces of this in your list. Can we achieve that? I haven't yet, but I can see it from here. And I think every once in a while I get a glimpse of a step or two that I probably ought to take that would move me a little closer. I'm going to give you a definition I gave you a long time ago, but some of you may not have been here then. In the Middle Ages, whenever the king would come out to the countryside, he might go visit his noblemen in their castles. And when he did, they would fly a special flag over the castle to signal that the king was in residence there. Joy is the flag that flies over the castle of my heart to signal that the king is in residence. Circumstances don't determine whether that flag flies. Circumstances do not determine whether that flag flies. Jesus did not come to make life easy. Jesus came to make people great. And sometimes the road of persecution is there. Every Christian ought to be ready for it. Recognize it, ready to recognize it, ready to take the appropriate steps to endure it. Not necessarily go looking for it, but not to avoid it when it's the only way through something. And there is joy, because that's sometimes when God is the closest with you. Let's have a word of prayer for them. Our Father, we thank you for the lesson this morning and for the lessons that have been in this series. And I pray this morning that some of the words that have been said will come alive and take root in people. And because you tell us in your book that if there is to be fruit above, the roots have to go deep. Teach us how to get our roots deep with you. Teach us how to grow fruit that is acceptable to you. Teach us how to work with your Spirit as the leader in our lives. All this we pray in your Son's name. Amen.